this. Category, which will be used to define quantum theory, was the category of all contravariant functors from the category of even to enormous algebras, just says. Now, it doesn't matter if you don't know what an even to enormous algebra is. I mean, I explained it in another lecture, but if you missed it, just think of it of abelian algebras of the algebra of bounded operators on Hilbert space. So it's the category of all contravariant functors from the category of abelian of algebras to set. And this forms a topos, and to summarize, the topos is a category which has loads of extra structure in it, such that any mathematical operation which can be done in set theory has a topos analog. So anything you can think of which you can do in set theory has a generalized version of topos. And of importance was the existence of the truth object, which didn't have just true or false, but had a set of truth values in it. So what this enabled you to do is the following. It enables, in a general topos, to ask this question. So imagine a subset, sub-object, and you ask, is this a sub-object of S? Answer, yes. That's the same as classical. If you have something that's nearly a sub-object, and you ask, is P a sub-object of S? Then, in a general topos, you get a well-defined answer to this question, and you get something in between. And if you have a sub-object that is even less a sub-object of S, and you ask the question, is a sub-object of S, then you get a truth value that is less. So, the main idea in a topos is that you have a truth object which allows you to define in a mathematically correct way what it means to nearly be a sub-object of something and how far you are from being a sub-object. And another thing is that you have an internal logic which was an integer. Which is a generalized version of a Boolean algebra, the only thing that the law of excluded middle doesn't hold. So, then what I explained was, given this topos, I started defining the abstract terms in the language in this topos. So we've done it for classical theory, we define state, space, state, etc. And now we do it for this topos. And I'll just write it down quickly because I already did it, but what is the state space? So the topos analog of your state space is the contravariant functor such that for each abelian algebra it assigns the spectrum of this algebra. And such that if you have an arrow in this category, an arrow in this category is given by inclusion. So if this is sub-algebra of that, you get an inclusion arrow. Then the respective arrow here, since the contravariant functor goes all the way around, and is defined in terms of restriction on the spectrum. So you map the spectrum of the bigger algebra, the spectrum of the small algebra by restriction. So the picture of this, so you have a category of sub-algebras. The state space is defined such that for each context you define the spectrum of that algebra. And if there's an arrow between the two contexts, there's an arrow between the two spectra. Yeah, this is a bit rushed because I'm trying to review what I did in the last lecture, but just to refresh in our minds. So the the state space in this Todros formalism is a collection of what you might think of as a classical state space. So, what does that mean? In quantum theory, the funny stuff, so it's a quantum theory, comes from non-commuting operators. But if you consider a billion subalgebras, then everything commutes. So you can consider this context as classical snapshots. So for each classical snapshot, you get kind of classical analog of your state space. You can consider this a classical state space. Only when you consider all of these classical snapshots, do you put back quantum information. So I mean, the information coming from quantum theory in the picture. And this is why that Todros was chosen. Because remember, the aim of using Todros theory to define quantum theory was to be able to re-express it in a more realist way. And this you can do it by describing each of the elements, your state space, your state, and so on, as a collection of local elements, such that locally they resemble a classical setting. And only when you consider all of the information together, then you put back the quantum information. So now the other thing that I did was also a concept of proposition, and that is the following. So proposition. Proposition was in abstract language was a term of this type. A subobject of your state object. And I said that in the previous lecture that in this context it's defined as follows. So imagine you have a proposition evaluated in a certain range. In quantum theory, this is associated with a projection operator, which projects on the other space for which this is true. In the topos, for each projection operator, you get contravariant Cauchy-Euler. Such that for each algebra, you associate the following. The first thing that you do is you define a local version of your proposition. So for each context V, you have to define the local representative of this proposition. So you go here, so imagine P does belong to B, that's fine. Then the local representative will be P itself. Then what you do, you go up here, and you pick out the elements of the spectrum of that algebra, which give value 1 to your local representative of your proposition. Then you go in a context where there isn't your proposition. What you do, you approximate it. So you pick out the smallest proposition which is in that context and which is implied by the original proposition. You pick out the smallest projection operator which is in here and which is bigger than this guy. Then you go up here and you consider the subset of the spectrum of this algebra here now, which gives value 1 to the local representative of your proposition for that context. And you do this for each context. So here you get for each context, you define the local representative of your proposition. And then you pick out the elements of the spectrum of the algebra, which give value 1 to this local proposition. Okay. So the main idea is that for each context you have a representative. It can also be the identity. I mean, you coarse-grain the proposition. Sometimes you have to coarse-grain it so much that you get the identity. But that doesn't matter. What matters is for each context, all of them, you get a representative and you get a certain subset of the state space. Okay, now actually I'll give an example of this. Right,
So,
in four dimensional space, choose the usual basis. And let's consider that we want to define, we want to know the spin in the z direction. Imagine two bodies. And you want to know the spin in the z direction. In particular, the proposition that you want to consider is whether the value of the spin in the z direction lies in a certain entity. That's the proposition. Given this basis, then the self-adjoint grid for the spin z would be this, all zeros. So the eigenvector, eigenvalues would be these. So the only actual value that isn't here would be 2. Now this eigenvector for this eigenvalue is this state here. So this proposition here is actually represented by this projection operator. And we have 0. Because the projection operator, which projects on this, is the same. The projection operator would project on the only eigenstate which has eigenvalue inside here. Is that clear? So this proposition, this projection operator represents this proposition. Okay, now we want to define our complement functor. Which represents this proposition. So the first thing we need to define are local representatives of that proposition. So we have to consider our algebras. So let's consider first the maximum of the Abelian algebra, which is simply the collection given this basis. This is simply the collection of all diagonal matrices with complex entries. So you can write like this. And this is an algebra, and it's a Abelian. So it's, it belongs to a category. Okay, this algebra, what is the local representative of this proposition in this algebra? Now this algebra contains the projection operator, which represents a proposition. So in this case, it's easy. The local representative is just itself. Now let's go on a smaller algebra. Let's go say in this algebra here. And this is defined as follows. It has only two projection operators, 3, and you sum the other ones. Now we want to define the local representative of this proposition in this algebra. Now that projection operator is not contained in this algebra, so you have to generalize it. And the only generalization of that projection operator is this guy here. All the others are orthogonal. So the local representative of the projection of this proposition for this context is this proposition here. So in words, right, if this proposition was the value of z lies in this interval, this generalized proposition would be the value of z lies in that interval there, or the value of z lies in lies in somewhere.
So this why would we choose one algebra instead of another one?
Excuse me?
So which, I mean, why would you choose that algebra?
Oh, this is just the other one. To do all of them.
What?
You have to do all of them.
Okay.
Oh, I just picked this one as an example. But for each algebra in here, you have to define your local representative.
Okay.
So this is just an example. So for this algebra, since your proposition doesn't belong to it, you have to generalize the proposition such that it belongs to this algebra, and you end up with this, which in words could be something like that. So this is obviously a more general proposition than the one we started off with. Then if you go to even a smaller algebra, say this one, again, the local representative of the proposition is now the only projection operator in here which is bigger than P1, and this is right here. So the local representative will be this proposition. So I don't know if it's clear, but for each context, you define your local representative, and the definition of this local representative is the smallest proposition which is true if your original one is true. So it's the smallest projection operator which is implied by your original one. Okay, so this, we are still here, right? So for each context, we define a local proposition. Now we have to define what are the elements of the state space which are associated to a local proposition. Okay, so let's... So again, let's consider this maximum algebra. The spectrum of this algebra here, since it has only four free projection operators, and since projection operators can have value 1 or 0, the only elements in the spectrum of that algebra are four elements, each of which will give 1 to one projection operator and 0 to the others. Okay, now I said that the propositions, this area, to each context, it associated the subset, certain elements of the spectrum, which gave value 1 to the local representative of that proposition. So for this context, the local representative is the proposition itself. So, what are the elements in the spectrum of this context which give value 1 to this proposition? And they're simply this. This gives value 1 to P1 and 0 to everything else. So, okay, so if we have it here. For this context, you have your proposition, so the only element up here will be the unique element of the spectrum of this algebra, which gives value 1 to this proposition. Then you go to a subcontext, so we'll go to this subcontext here. The spectrum of that subcontext, since it only has three operators, it will only have three elements. This will give value 1 to P2, and zero to everything else, this will give value 1 to p3 and 0 to everything else, and this will give value 1 to p1 plus p4. Okay, so we know that the representative for that context of a proposition is this projection operator. So the only element which gives value 1 to that projection operator is this guy here. So up here, you only get, again, just one element. You get this one. And so on. So for this context here, the spectrum has only two elements, because it only has two free projection operators. So it has this one that gives value 1 to p2, not p3, sorry. P3 and 0 to everything else. And this that gives value 1 to p1 plus p2 plus p3 and 0 to everything else. So our local representative is this generalized proposition. So for that context, you will associate a subset of the spectrum comprised of those elements which give value 1 to our generalized proposition. And so on. So again, I know that this is clear, but the main idea is that for each context, you generalize your proposition as much as you can in order for it to fit that context, in order for it to be a well-defined proposition in that context, and then you pick out the elements of the spectrum of that context which give value 1 to your generalized proposition. So you have a collection of local propositions, and only when you take them all together do you get your full quantum proposition, your full global proposition. Okay. So that was the concept of intuition. Now the other is the concept of truth value, well, of the truth object. So we've seen that in classical physics, the truth object was simply the set, well, sorry, 0, 1, just others two articles. And I said that in Tuple's theory, you get many more truth values, which enable you to give the mathematical analog of the linguistic words nearly true, almost true, and so on. So what is this truth object in this topos? So it has to be a confirmed functor. So it has to be a natural cross. It has to be a Abelian algebras, two sets. And what does it do? For each algebra, it defines a set. This set is defined to be as the collection of all sets comprised of subalgebras of your algebra. So all possible sets of algebras which are subalgebras of a given algebra. And so as you have the empty set, and this will be the analog of the classical poles, you will have the biggest set of subalgebras which contains also the algebra you're considering, but in between you have other sets, both of them. All of these will be subalgebras of your algebra. Right? So you can see that you get the classical analog of false, and you get the classical analog of truth, which is the biggest of the sets. But in between, you get a lot of different truth values.
So at first, I mean, I got the impression that it would be like another thing, but now it doesn't look ordered at all, right?
Oh, no, it is ordered. I mean,
not linearly ordered.
No.
But So it's not linearly ordered. So.
Well, it's ordered by including. I mean, this you can compare two things.
I mean, you cannot compare whether one thing. I mean, one thing is nearly true, another one is nearly true. You cannot see which is more true, right?
You can. Okay, wait a minute. There's one property as well. Right. So, if. So, these things are called states. Right? I'll just answer. I'll say this in a. So, a property of the sieve is that if an algebra belongs to a sieve, then all its subalgebras will belong to the sieve. So you can, you can actually compare them. There'll be some. The comparison is how many elements you will have in each sieve.
You can compare some of that.
Yeah.
Yes. You can compare the set with V1, V2, V3 with the set with only V3.
Yeah. And V1. Okay, some you can't. So the ones that contain the set. It is ordered by two.
So not every two elements are comparable?
No, but it's as. The thing is that when you define the truth value, it will be defined in terms of how many of the subalgebras will be in the truth value.
Oh, sorry, so this is not, I thought this would construct already.
No.
Okay.
So.
I see, okay, sorry.
So the sieve, each sieve is a collection of subalgebras of the canal. So I'll give an example of what this is. So again here. So we want to define the collection of sieves for our algebras. So we consider first the maximal function. So what is the collection of sieves for this maximal algebra? So you have the empty sieve, you have the maximal sieve, is defined by all possible subalgebra, so it will contain itself and it will contain all the others. So the ones defined by keeping two projection operators fixed and the one defined by keeping one. And then we will have all other sieves, which I'll write down when I explain. Of the algebra where you keep all your two projection operators fixed and all its subalgebras. And then, for example, this one is defined by the algebra which you keep one fixed, and okay, it doesn't have any subalgebras other than the trigger one, so it's just that. The collection of sieves is all possible subsets of your algebra. So if you go to a smaller algebra, say this one, then set of sieves on this one is the empty one, as usual. The maximal one that now, according to the notation, is this one. And then this two. You understand this notation? That's not what I mean by this. Okay, then if you go to a smaller one, so this one, then you get the empty set, you get the principal one, and that's all you get here. Now you can actually, since this is a controversial functor, you can define, for each inclusion, you can define maps here, which go all the way around. And these are defined as follows. For each sieve, you can see in this collection of sieves, the biggest one, which is contained in this guy. So to each sieve, you just define the intersection of that sieve with the smaller algebra, and you obtain the biggest sieve in the set which is contained in this. So, for example, if you wanted to find this map, so the principal sieve gets mapped to the principal sieve intersection with this algebra here. Now the principal sieve, well, I should delete this. But the principal sieve there was defined by all possible algebras. So it will also contain this algebra here. And if it contains this algebra here, it will also contain all the subalgebras. So this will be this guy. Since the algebra 2, 3 is contained, the intersection with this algebra and this algebra and this algebra, intersection with this algebra and this algebra and this algebra, so that's what you obtain.
It's not a naive inclusion, it's not a naive intersection, it's something more. It's a
intersection. And you have a set.
You take the intersection with everybody, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, just to try and describe, but yeah. I mean, you restrict this sieve to all of the subalgebras of this. So, to describe as intersection. So, of the algebras that are here, you pick out all the ones that are also subalgebras of this. And it's a better way of saying. For example, if you get this one, which is this has this algebra, the intersection with this is empty. Right? There's no algebras in here, which are also subalgebras of this one. So here we would get the empty it. So again, the picture of all this. For each algebra, you associate the set of sieves, which have the empty sieve and the principal sieve as the maximum elements. And such that the maps between the set of sieves are given in terms of these restrictions. So again, even for the truth object, you get a kind of collection of local representatives of your truth object, and then you put all the information together. Now, nearly the last thing is the concept of a state. Now, the concept of a state is very similar to the concept of a composition. So, we want to represent a state in this topos. Now, the interesting thing is that the state space has no points. And I don't know if you're familiar, but there's a theorem in quantum theory, which is called the Cauchy-Specker theorem, which tells you that you cannot assign values to all quantities at the same time in a consistent way. That's part of why quantum theory is not realistic. Anyway, the topos analog of that theorem is that the state space has no points. Where a point, like I said in the first lecture, is a map. So this state space has no such map. So what this means is that you cannot define a state as the categorical analog of a point. It has to be something more general. And what it is as following. So to each state, you associate the conjunction operator associated with the state. And then you do exactly the same as you said that you did for propositions. So you define a machine as a contrarian functor such that for each context you pick out the local representative of this projection operator. And then you assign the set of elements in the spectrum of the algebra, which now give value 1 to this projection operator. Exactly the same that you did for proposition. Oh, but this is not a proposition, since this is a one-dimensional, based on a one-dimensional surface of Hilbert space. So in that sense, this perceive is the closest you can get to a point. This state space. That's not quite the point. I mean, this is an object of this type. So it's a sub-object on a state space. And you do this for all contexts. So for all contexts, you get your local representative of your state. And then you assign the elements in the spectrum of an algebra, which give value 1 to your local representative of the state. And this is the concept of state. Okay, now finally, I arrive at how you define truth values. So we have the concept of a proposition, we have the concept of a state. What is the truth value of a proposition given state? And this is really what, I mean, all this is all rather abstract and complicated, but the main result is precisely that in this setting, you can define truth values of any proposition regarding values of quantity of this system all at the same time, also incompatible proposition. So any proposition you can think of, you can define in this way, and you can define the truth value of it. Okay, so in order to understand what truth value is, let's go back to classical physics. So this is a proposition. Now in classical physics, I've said in the first lecture, this is identified with all those states in the state space, such that the value of that quantity does lie in the Bobby range. All those states such that that proposition is true. And this is a subset of your state space. So, given a position and given a state, we want to know what's the truth value of that proposition given the state. In classical physics, that is 1 if S belongs to this subset and 0 otherwise. So, this, the truth value of a proposition given a state, is equivalent to the mathematical statement that S is an element of the appropriate subobject, subset of the state space, right? Is equivalent. This is what the proposition is, and this is the state. As you consider the state as a singleton, then this statement is equivalent to the following. So this singleton is a subset of your set, such that the proposition is true. So in classical theory, you can define the truthfulness of a proposition in terms of an inclusion relation. Now we're going to do exactly the same thing for quantum theory in the context of Pauli's theory. So we're going to define given a state relation. I said that both this is the object of type P sigma, subobject of state space, and also this is an object of type P sigma. So it makes sense to define truthfulness in terms of inclusion relations. So the truth value of this proposition given state is P in terms of inclusion. Now, since we have the topos of contrary functors, everything has to be defined for each context. So we'll have the notion of contextual truth values or local truth values. So for a context V, for an algebra, what is the truth value of this proposition given state? And this is defined as follows. It's defined as the collection of subalgebras of this algebra, such that the local representative of the proposition in this subalgebra is true given the state. So what this truth value says in words is the following, that it tells you how much you have to generalize a proposition in order for it to be true, given the state. So, in pictures, so this is your proposition, this object, and this is your state. This truth value tells you how much you have to coarse grain your proposition such that that state, that proposition is true given that state. How much you have to generalize it such that this is a full subobject. Now I'll give an example of what this actually is. Which might be a little more understandable. So again, you have the usual basis. And imagine the proposition is that the spin in the direction lies in this interval. So again, the only values are minus 2, 0, 2. So here the only possible value is minus 2, which means that the projection operator associated to this proposition is this thing here. And then imagine you're given the state. And the question is this proposition true given the state? So, here's the question. This is obviously the public representative of the state. That's the proposition. And you want to define it, what's the truth value of this proposition given the state. Let's say we start for our maximum subalgebra. So we want to define all the subalgebras such that this is true. Okay, so again, you start with a big algebra. This is all diagonal matrices with complex matrices. And you see, okay, does this algebra belong to this set? In order to understand it, you first have to define the local representative of your proposition for this algebra. Now, since this algebra contains this projection operator which represents a proposition, the local representative here is just the proposition itself. And obviously, this doesn't give one. So, this algebra will not be in here. So you go to small algebra. So what this means is you have to generalize the proposition so that it can be true. So you go. You go to small algebras. So say you go. Which is a subalgebra of the maximum algebra. Okay, what's the local representative of this proposition in this algebra? And we've seen. So this is the smallest projection operator, which is implied by P4. So this is this guy here. Now for this projection operator, it is actually true that this is equal to 1. So this algebra will go in here, will be an element of the truth set. And you see that this proposition is more general. So this would tell you that the spin in the z direction is in this interval. P1 is a proposition that we used before, for example. And P1 tells you that the spin in the z direction was in this interval. So this is obviously a much more general proposition than just that one. But it's general enough so that this is true. And you continue. For example, if you go to even a smaller one, like this one, And the local representative would be this dual projection operator, which is implied by P4, which is in here. And also for this context, it is true that this is equal to 1. So also this algebra will go in here. So it's really, and this is only for one context, right? Then you have to do it for all contexts. But for each context, what this does and works is that it defines the local representative of the truth value of this proposition. And this local representative is given in terms of how much you have to generalize the proposition in order for it to be true, given the state. And so you can see that in this formalism, when you prove any given a system, you can really define the truth value of any proposition for a given state. And you can also define truth values of a compatible proposition. I mean, I did this, but then you can start asking, given the state, what is the value of the z direction in a given interval? And you get, again, well-defined values for this question. So the main achievement, so to say, is that you really obtain a well-defined quantum logic for each proposition of a given system, any proposition we want to talk about. Now, unfortunately, I don't have time, but I did actually pull up my lecture notes, but in the lecture notes I describe how it is possible to define a correspondence between truth values and probability measures. So that in this framework now, you, at the very underlying level, there's the logical structure, and this logical structure is independent of what you might call of external observable measurements. And it turns out that for each probability measure can be reconstructed by this truth value. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between truth values and probability measures, so that you can regain all the probability of science one. But I read on, it is in the lecture notes, but I don't have time now exactly to introduce other things. But the importance is to understand how these truth values are constructed, and the fact that you can define truth values for any proposition.
So, two questions about these truth values. Why value is not a value at all? And what's the point of having truth value which is not zero for a state which is orthogonal to the thing we might want to measure?
Oh no, you would have also a zero one. I mean, it can be
there. But but it's not just zero.
No, you can also get empty.
But you didn't get it. I thought you should get empty.
Case, no, that's...
Since you have a state which is orthogonal to the thing you wanted to measure, I thought, oh, this has to be the empty set, but it's not. What's the meaning? What does it mean that you actually have something else in the
truth
value?
Well, you get an empty set for those contexts in which you're really considering the proposition which is orthogonal to your state. But when you coarse grain a proposition, then you won't get empty. For example, this algebra, I mean, if it is possible to get the empty sieve for proposition, that is never true no matter how much you coarse grain, that you get empty sieve for the context. Locally, you can get the empty set for context in which your proposition is orthogonal to your state. But then you generalize the proposition. So when you go
You've done that. I see. I mean, the example is quite clear. It's just that it's very hard to understand why we should do such a thing. To me, it just looks weird. I already know that it's a state orthogonal. But orthogonality doesn't have any meaning here at all, then. It has to come into with the probabilities, which I haven't told us about. But
it does come locally. this coming locally, and yeah, okay, I didn't talk about probability. But in those cases, you have to define another object, but in those cases, you do get zero for certain fault or whatever. But locally, you still do get the constant orthogonal for a given algebra. It's just that when you consider all together, then okay. But because, I mean, the truth value here is conceptually different. It's not just saying this true or false, it's saying how far off from being true it is. So locally, then it's not true. But this tells you how far off from being true.
Do you think it's more realistic, perhaps? Okay, that this is a more realistic view of me?
By realist, I just mean that you can assign value, truth values, to all propositions at the same time. Okay,
but the truth value is just something
valid, yeah.
Weird.
It's not realist, it's not really realist. But it enables you to look in, to define this concept of truth values for all propositions. And they do undergo a Haitian algebra, the collection of all truth values, and the collection of all propositions do undergo a Haitian algebra, so you can actually do things with them. But yes, the truth values are these, what they call neorealism.
What's the difference between neorealist and realist?
They don't just get true or false, you have this multi values. It's kind of made up.
It just means you allow more general truth value. Yeah. Neo means you allow more general.
Yeah.
But people have often considered like three-value logics a long time ago in order to... So they would all fit within... They might... I mean...
Yeah, but those
allowing more truth values is not in itself such a dramatic, such a radical departure,
no.
I would say.
No. The only difference, as far as I know, in those approaches, you don't get all the correct way of defining logical connectives, and in this way you can get the non-logical connectives consistent.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that those were neorealist necessarily, but I'm saying it's the only difference between neorealism and realism is that you allow more general truth values. Then it seems like maybe it's not so far away. Neo is not, realist is not so far away from realist.
Yeah, well, this is plus. You still get to the 0-1 limits.
So, how does it work with the mixed state? Can you just put in the density operator instead of the predictor?
Yes.
Okay.
I actually write that in the lectures, because then you have to define a truth object which is dependent on this. But yeah, you can put it.
So I think when Andreas was lecturing on this, when he gave a talk on this, I asked him what it had to say about the measurement problem. And he said, because to many people the measurement problem is kind of the epitome of what's hard to understand about quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
His answer at that time was, well, we took away the measurement and we left the problem. So, is that, what's the current?
Well, it's a bit less of a problem because of this. We managed to show that you can reconstruct probability measures from truth values. But we still don't.
Well, but the thing is that what is the meaning, the physical meaning of probability? It's just a number that you attach, but.
And why is it an interval then?
What?
It turns out it's an interval, but yes.
The probability is an interval.
Yeah, we don't really have numbers here.
Oh, okay. Some sort of topo-sized number.
Analog of numbers.
But I mean, just attaching numbers doesn't in itself tell you.
Probability
means then there's some big debate or something, but it's a frequency and repetitions or someone, you know, there's some physical sense that's attached to that number. So is there an analog of that in this framework?
No, not really, other than you can construct probability measures from truth values. We don't In this framework, we don't really know what the concept of measurement would be.
Since in principle, you would have to do a whole neo-realistic story about foray. I mean, what I'm worried about, I mean, you could imagine doing it for a complex system consisting of a measurement apparatus and an object system and so on and so on and so on. But suppose you could do all that, would you expect to find a notion of measurement in there somehow?
Yeah, I think it would be some kind of, okay, I'm speculating, but it could be some kind of functor from something, something. I'm not, you don't really, there's a logic and truth about this, so you don't really, it is true, we took away the measurement.
Yeah, because the usual story is that the problem is somehow localized in the wave function. If you take the wave function to be the reality, which is, I think, not too far from what you've done here, because your reality or your neo-reality is this set of truth values, but they're all driven in this story, they're all driven by the wave function. I know Chris wants to do something more general where you don't do that, but as far as this goes so far, as you've presented it, all this reality is determined. So it's almost as if the wave function is real. But then when the wave function is real, you have the problem of its collapse, which either doesn't happen, in which case it doesn't agree with reality, or it does happen, in which case you don't know how it happened. Something is missing out of the quantum story. So one would hope that this would put that in a new light or allow you to...
Yeah, well, I mean, I did describe everything with this object, but there is a generalized system, the truth object, which was done, but it's more general. It doesn't make use of directly of the states. So there is a way of generalizing it a bit, so that you can define truth values without having to introduce this pseudo state.
So then could you maybe, I know you've worked on histories version, given a space-time version, not just a moment-of-time version, would there be some hope of getting definite measurement outcomes using this more general thing, pi, and in the histories framework?
The idea would be, yeah, to try and do that. But, yeah, it hasn't been done, but that would be the aim.
That's the aim, I see.